Okay, so this is Dr. Nesbitt, Laquandra Nesbitt from the board certified. She's a board certified family physician and currently Senior Deputy Director of Community Health Administration, District of Columbia, Department of Health.
So I'm going to switch gears just a little bit and speak of environment in the context of the built environment. So we're stepping away a little bit from air and cortisol and biophysical markers, and we'll focus for the purposes of this presentation on the built environment. In DC, we've done a lot of work about this, primarily because our advocacy community has been extremely vocal as it relates to concerns with the obesity epidemic, both youth and adult. And we wanted to make sure that we're equipping our advocacy community with the correct information. The thing that makes advocates less valuable to us is when they don't have correct information or when they're using anecdotal information, then they're immediately dismissed by policymakers, et cetera. So we wanted to make sure that they really have enough concrete information. What I'm presenting here is more of a statistical study. We've done a descriptive EPI report that goes into far more detail, and I can speak to you all about how to get a copy of that at the end if you're interested. So I have, no one pays me. We can go to the next one. Outline, so again, we'll talk briefly about DC demographics so I can kind of orient you to the city. We'll give you a little bit of description about obesity in the District of Columbia, then we'll move through the study. And what's more important for me as a physician who's done policy training is that everything we do in terms of study has a policy implication and that we're being aware of what those implications are. So this is the District of Columbia, which is a little diamond with a piece missing. We're surrounded by Maryland and Virginia. On most U.S. maps, we are aligned with D.C., so no one really knows what we look like or what the shape is. I'll illustrate here. I apologize for forgetting my pointer, and I have a loud mouth, so stop walking away from the microphone shouldn't be a problem. But Ward 7 and 8 are where most of our poverty is consolidated in the district, and between Wards 6, 7, and 8, there's something called the Anacostia River. So we often refer to east of the river being our under-resourced and vulnerable populations. Wards are our geopolitical construct. Council members are elected by ward. Resources are divvied up by ward. When you ask someone where they live, they tell you which ward. So when we speak about community-level risk factors, we tend to keep it at the ward level. Again, these are just more demographics for the District of Columbia. This is from the 2000 census. From the 2007 American Community Survey, our population is just shy of 600,000. What I wanted to illustrate with this particular slide is that DC has quite a bit of racial segregation. So you can see there in Ward 3, 83% of the population is white. You look at Ward 7 and 8, 92% of the population is black. And then our Latino population is fastest growing. It's at 23% in Ward 1. Ward 4 is the second highest. And these are going to have some implications when we start looking at some of the GIS mapping that we did later. It's going to be important for you to remember the racial composition of these communities. DC is a young city. The median age is 34.9. So when you get ready to get married and have children, you have suburban flights. This age is also relatively low because a lot of people move into the District of Columbia to work on the Hill. And as many of you know, Hill jobs do not pay very well, so once you're about 35 and you're ready to make money, you leave the city. DC has a dichotomy in a couple of arenas. One that I want to highlight here is education. While 14.2% of the population has less than a high school education, over 25% of the population has a graduate degree, not a bachelor's degree or associate's degree, a graduate or professional degree. So that's significantly greater than what most urban communities have in this country. And then for language, 4.6% of our residents are not proficient in English, and I've listed there the four most common languages for you all to keep in mind as well. These are our age-adjusted death rates. On your left, you have the District of Columbia 2008 rates, and then on the right, you have the United States 2007 rates. I highlight this here just basically to show that the same causes of death that are around the nation are present in DC, with the exception of HIV/AIDS and homicide make our list, and they don't make the national list, haven't for quite some time, whereas on the US list, you have septicemia and nephritis, which don't make our list as well. I also want to highlight that, you know, the first two are big front runners for heart disease and neoplasms, and then the distant third is cerebral vascular disease. In the District of Columbia, we're really trying to have a paradigm shift about talking about disease. So we've been doing this for years, the leading causes of death. This drives resources. So we give out grants. We invest in healthcare systems. We create clinical interventions, et cetera, to help target the leading causes of death. But we don't really talk about behavior. We don't really talk about which deaths we can actually prevent when we start thinking about premature mortality. Next slide. So last year we did a study. This is actually used to statistical modeling that looked at what are the preventable deaths in the District of Columbia. And as you can see there, number one is the use of tobacco products, and number two is physical inactivity and poor nutrition combined. They account for 33% of our preventable deaths and 15% of our total deaths. So we're talking about being able to make an impact on our death rates in our city if we began to effectively address issues related to physical inactivity and poor nutrition. So as a result of that, we start thinking about what we call the health impact construct. And this is sort of a modification of a pyramid that if any of you go to CDC conferences or HRSA meetings, et cetera, and they talk about how you create interventions or how you correctly began to solve a lot of the public health or healthcare problems. And as you can see there, education, that's what we've been doing for years. So community-based organizations and departments of health, they partner and we do health fairs and we pass out literature and we host sessions and we talk about the dangers of heart disease. We talk about the signs and symptoms of stroke. We tell you how to read a menu. We do all of those things, but the impact still hasn't been there. We see that we continue to have declining health status in our area. Clinical interventions is another place that there's a lot of investments made. NIH. As a whole enterprise related to funding clinical interventions. Not until you get to the base of the pyramid where you start to talk about socioeconomic factors, which, you know, various slides show various things. Dr. Jenkins' slide yesterday said about 10%, showed that over 30% is related to these socioeconomic factors. Some literature say that as much as 75% is related to socioeconomic factors. So we see our role as a health department in being able to help address some of those socioeconomic factors, which at this type of conference are more commonly referred to social determinants of health. In the real world, they're just helping people who do regular business understand how the business they do is related to health. So that's engaging transportation to let them know how what they do has an impact on public health, schools, planning, economic development, et cetera. So, of course, this is the factors contributing to obesity. So we talk about built environment, access to healthy food options, access to recreational facilities and parks. The district, every resident in the District of Columbia lives within a quarter mile of a park or recreation facility, unmeasured with any other city. No one else really does that. So we have lots of green space and parks, but yet in Ward 7 and 8, 42% of our population is obese. So we have to dig a little bit deeper. We can't just say build more parks and recreation facilities. Now we've got to look at other layers such as crime, public safety, availability of the facilities, even though they're built and they're there, education about their use, et cetera. For this particular presentation, we're going to talk about access to healthy food options, and we'll do a little statistical dive into that problem in the District of Columbia. So the study objectives were to really examine the association of fruit and vegetable consumption and waste status in the District of Columbia. So you all have heard of food deserts, and food deserts are a problem because you don't have full-scale grocery stores, and so everyone eats at the corner store or the fast food place or the carryout. And those foods tend to have higher fat, higher sodium, and higher sugar content. So we wanted to look at whether or not there's a correlation between your weight association and the actual fruit vegetable consumption. This was very easy for us because we administer the behavioral risk factor surveillance system survey. Another objective was to examine the relationship of eating establishments and food purchasing options in DC. So again, really looking at the impact of the food deserts and what resources are available and obesity, and then looking at that relationship and your ability to be able to meet the requisite fruit and vegetable requirement. All right, so this is an ecological study, which basically means that the population is the unit of analysis and not the individual. Our data sources, we use the BRFSS survey, and then at the Department of Health, we're fortunate to have our Health Regulation and Licensing Administration, which is part of our own agency. They go out and license and they do inspections of all of the food establishments, so they have the most comprehensive and up-to-date list. Variables, as you can see there, I won't read them for you, and all of the, you know, wonk statistical methods that we use, I'll spare you those as well. For a study population, a BRFSS is a survey. It's a 12-month survey. and it's done by random digit dialing. In 2007 in the District of Columbia, we only used landlines. In 2010, we began the use of cell phone technology. The CDC is still trying to figure out how to incorporate that cell phone data into the overall data reports and how the weighting metrics and things of that are going to play out. What I wanted to highlight here is that you do see some differences between the averages and the prevalence or the frequency of certain characteristics in this data set as opposed to what the District of Columbia has in general. For example, the average age is older than our median age. So our median age is 34.9, average age of respondent is 45.7. Blacks make up about 60 to 64% of the population in the district, but only 45% of respondents. So there's some slight discrepancy between who responds to BRFSS and our actual population, but statistical methodology such as weighting help to alleviate some of those discrepancies. And the other thing I wanted to highlight here is our overweight and obesity. So overweight 33.2, obesity 22. In 2007, this was actually lower than the national average. But remember what I said before about our disparity. So Ward 7 and 8, your obesity rates are 42%. So if they were really, you know, if they were accounted for more of the actual population in the district, then our obesity numbers would be much higher. But because we have a significant amount of our population who is of normal weight or underweight, they help to bring that average down. So when you're looking at our data just in a national data set, it doesn't look like we have a problem. But if you break it out by the community level, such as the ward, you really begin to see that there's a huge amount of disparities and definitely something we need to pay attention to. So food purchasing options by count, we're going to see some maps, and these are color-coded, but as you all can imagine, projecting color-coded dotted maps in this environment isn't going to be as precise as we'd like it to be. So here you see that grocery stores is only 31. Ward 7 and 8 has a total of 3 full-scale grocery stores combined. Remember that large part of the city? And they're actually at the polar ends of the ward, so there's nothing centrally. Whereas we have about 483 dine-in restaurants. Most of those are in our business district. And then traditional fast food and carryouts are the places where people get most of that high fat, high sodium content food in our lower income neighborhoods. So our hypothesis was that the higher the prevalence of fruit and vegetable consumption, the lower the prevalence of obesity in the district. So if you eat more fruits and vegetables, you're less likely to be obese. We didn't find that to be true with our BRFSS data. What we did find was that there was an association. I've highlighted in red the ones that are statistically significant, is that if you are a female, if your race is black or Hispanic, race or ethnicity is black or Hispanic, and that if your education is less than that of a college graduate or less than a college graduate, you're more likely to be obese based on those factors. Whether or not you consume fruits and vegetables, especially the recommended more than 5 a day, if you see there, your risk of being overweight is only 1.18 times higher if you don't consume the appropriate amount of fruits and vegetables. And because the confidence interval includes 1, it's not statistically significant. So it didn't really prove that there was an association there. But we were able to see some of the other ones. Now, the difference between undigested and adjusted is that for adjusted, we allow for the confounders, which we believe to be race, gender, and education. They were adjusted for in that particular model. If you see here, again, blue is where obesity rates are highest. And then there's an overlay, which again, in this room may not be projecting properly, but there's a hash mark lines. And as you can see here, darker lines mean that you consume fewer fruits and vegetables. So when you do the GIS mapping overlay, you do see that there is some relationship, although it's not a statistically significant relationship. So neighborhoods that have higher rates of obesity do have lower consumption of the 5 or more fruits and vegetables, but it's just not a statistically significant relationship. Now, the next set of hypotheses that we looked at was whether the relationship between the food establishments that you have access to and your weight status, as well as whether or not you were consuming the appropriate amount of fruits and vegetables. So we did notice when we did this some negative correlations using -1 and +1 with a Pearson's correlation. Negative correlation, obesity and fruit and vegetable consumption. So when you do a correlation, you see that it's there. If you're the higher your weight or the higher your BMI, the less likely or the lower the prevalence of consuming fruits and vegetables. obesity in organic markets, there was a negative association, as well as obesity in full-scale grocery stores. There was a positive correlation between organic markets and fruit and vegetable consumption and grocery stores and fruit and vegetable consumption, meaning that if these were in your neighborhood, you were more likely to have access to fruits and vegetables and thus consume them. Again, these are, again, maps. Focus on the purple dots. Those are bad. So the purple dots are bad food options. That's your fast food, your carryouts, the convenience stores, which may or may not have you know, bananas at the counter or some of the other things that we've included in the Healthy Corner Store initiative. And as you can see, when you look here, you concentrate in the center of the city and you see a lot of dots. That's our business district. If you've ever been to DC, you know, there's a lot of foot traffic in the downtown area during the daytime. So you have restaurant upon restaurant upon restaurant there. We broke this down a little bit further into what we call traditional fast food, which are your greasy food chains and the newly marketed healthier fast food options. When we break that down, we see that more of the healthier fast food options do cluster into that part of the city. And then you can see here in Ward 3, where that's where the more affluent residents live, they have fewer dots of purple dots than in Ward 7 and 8. And then purchasing options, when we talk about grocery stores, again, the grocery stores are the green dots. So very few of those in Ward 7. Some of the ones in Ward 7, remember I said there were three full-scale grocery stores. So some stores, we could define grocery stores by the amount of square footage that they have. So they may not be full-scale stores such as a large chain like a Giant or a Safeway or a Kroger or something of that nature, but a much smaller independently owned and operated grocer. And again, you can see that the higher rates of obesity, they have less access to these places where you could actually purchase fruits and vegetables. And again, you see clustering in Wards 2 and 3 and parts of Ward 5, again, which are business districts. And this is the prevalence of fruit and vegetable consumption and food purchasing options. So again, one of those slides that has an overlay. The overlay is the percentage of, or the prevalence of fruit and vegetable consumption. And then the purple and green dots represent the grocery stores. And as you can see, where there are more grocery stores here in Ward 3, your prevalence of consuming fruits and vegetables is much higher. And then we did a spatial analysis to talk about whether or not these types of establishments cluster as random chance or if it's intentional. And when you're looking at the Moran's Eye, which is the GI, which is a spatial analysis tool that's used, minus one, it means that there's perfect dispersion, and plus one means that there's perfect correlation. Zero means that it's all random chance. And as you can see here, it's pretty much random. And you look at the z-test for statistical significance, it has to be 1.96 or greater, or minus 1.96 or smaller. So again, this is showing us that, yes, there may be some clustering, yes, there may be some dispersion, but there are other factors such as zoning and planning and economic development that could play a factor in that, more so than just random selection by the vendors. So conclusions, residents in areas with limited access to purchasing options for healthful foods have lower rates of fruit and vegetable consumption and are more likely to be obese. There is not a statistically significant association between weight status and fruit and vegetable consumption. And then surveying residents regarding food purchasing behaviors may yield different findings. So BRFSS just asked if you eat five or more fruits and vegetables. It's a total recall survey. What we're trying to do moving forward is ask questions about if you live in a neighborhood that has a number of yum-yums and other carryouts that aren't more popular or aren't national chains, how often do you go to them? So we don't want to make assumptions about the fact that just because it's there, you frequent it commonly, and that you're more obese because you're frequenting the place often, but we want to get some data as to whether or not that's truly happening. Some limitations, again, BRFS data is self-reported. Restaurant and store data was not available for the same time period as BRFSS data. So the BRFSS data is 2007. The restaurant food establishment data that we used was from 2007. And we also didn't do ground truthing, meaning we didn't physically go to places to see if the establishment existed. We relied on the fact that if it was on the inspection list for 2010, that it would be inspected during that year. And they would remove it from the list if the place didn't exist. So what are some quick policy implications? I'm slightly over time. Menu labeling and Affordable Care Act. So it requires that if you have 20 or more chain restaurants, you have to label your menus. Well, in DC, as we've done our descriptive EPI reports and even this study here, The large chains aren't really our bad food source problem. It's more the independent carryouts. So having something that's blanket, if you have 20 or more, won't have that same policy impact in the District of Columbia as it may have in other places where the McDonald's and Wendy's, et cetera, are more prevalent. Zoning regulations and vending codes have a huge part to play in this. If you're having neighborhoods that have been zoned as residential, they may have become food deserts by virtue of being zoned as residential. No one can come in and build a full-scale grocery store. There was also restrictions to where you could vend in the District of Columbia, so farmers markets weren't freely available in the district as well. And more recently, there's been a push, there's a piece of legislation, the Food, Environment, and Economic Development Act, which is driving to look at the way subsidies are provided to grocers and farmers, et cetera, and making sure that they give preference to locating themselves in what we call our food deserts and helping to provide more resources to those communities that have been under-resourced. So here's our list of acknowledgments. I actually had an MPH student who worked with this as her final project, Daniela Herdman, who then joined the department after her time with us. And then Dr. Vigilance, who is the director for the DC Department of Health, is also here in the back room, so I want to be sure to acknowledge him as well. And then the rest of our team in the Center for Policy Planning and Epidemiology, which was my home prior to moving to the Community Health Administration. And this is my contact information. The slides are posted on APHA.org. And for the sake of time, I'll take questions after the last presenter.
Okay, thank you.